Your ability to negotiate effectively in your best interests is central to your success in work and in life. Negotiating and compromising are a major part of the business of living, communicating, and interacting with others. You begin to negotiate in infancy, and you continue to negotiate through to the present moment. It never stops. Life can even be viewed as one long, extended negotiating session, from the cradle to the grave. Negotiating is just the way in which individuals with differing values and interests find constructive ways to live and work together in harmony. Your ability to negotiate well on your own behalf largely determines how well you do in almost every area of your life. I began studying negotiating many years ago. In the course of my career, I've negotiated many millions of dollars worth of contracts involving residential, commercial, and industrial real estate. I've negotiated the purchase, construction, and lease of shopping centers and office buildings. I've negotiated the development and sale of residential subdivisions. Over one three-year period, I negotiated the importation and distribution of over $25 million worth of automobiles. I've also negotiated contracts for printing, consulting, training, advertising, conventions and meetings, and the sales of thousands of items. What I'm saying is that the material you're about to learn is based on extensive experience. And it works. If you systematically apply even a small part of what is contained in these sessions, you will realize a major improvement in the quality and quantity of your results. Negotiating and bargaining have been going on since the beginning of human society. Negotiating takes place because each person is keenly interested in maintaining and improving his or her relative position in life. Compromise, trading, negotiating is how we balance conflicting and competing wants to assure that each person achieves the best possible outcome for himself or herself. Negotiating is rooted in what has been called the subjective theory of value. This theory simply says that value is always in the eyes of the beholder. There's no intrinsic value or price on anything, only the price that someone is willing to pay for it. The subjective theory of value also says that different people place different values on different things at different times and for different reasons. At the same time, different people will value money more than goods and services, and other people will value the goods and services more than the money. It is these subjective valuations that create the desire to exchange goods, services, money, and other items. As they say, it's differences of opinion that make a horse race. This brings us to the first basic principle of successful negotiating, and that is, everything is negotiable. There are very few fixed prices and terms on anything that you want to purchase, not even if they're written down in the boldest, blackest letters. When the average person goes into a store or goes to purchase any item, he has a natural tendency to believe that if a price is written down, much less printed, then the price must be fixed in some way. However, all prices are subjective. They are the best guess estimate of what the market will bear at a particular time. In many cases, the written prices are not even meant to be taken seriously. They are simply put there as the starting point for bargaining. Remember, negotiating to get the best price or the best deal is part of the game of life. As long as you look upon it as a game, you can avoid getting tense or nervous in a negotiating situation. Simply smile to yourself, get in there, and play the game. The key to negotiating and getting better prices and terms is simply to ask. You can ask politely. You can ask innocently. You can ask curiously. But be sure to ask. Ask why the price is so high. Ask for better terms. Ask for more for the same price. Ask for a better deal or a lower price. Because all prices are arbitrarily set by someone in the back room or the head office, all prices are subject to negotiation in some way and on some basis. You must develop the attitude that all prices are negotiable and then be continually looking for opportunities to improve each deal and each bargaining situation in your favor. One of the fastest ways to achieve financial success is to pay less for the things that you buy and to get more for the things that you sell. A good bargainer or negotiator can earn as much net income in 5 years as a poor negotiator might earn in 20 years of equally hard work. The primary reason why people are not better negotiators is the fear of rejection. We're conditioned from childhood to be very sensitive to the acceptance and approval of other people. If we feel that by asking for a better price, the other person may become upset or angry or express disapproval of us, we often accept the written price passively and end up by paying far more than we need to. The key to overcoming the fear of rejection that holds you back from getting the best deals for yourself is to confront the fear by practicing over and over. Develop the habit of looking upon every interchange as a negotiation and just practice. Here's an example of what I mean. A few years ago, in February, I went into the most expensive menswear store in the city and I was looking at a beautiful cashmere coat. I tried it on and it fit perfectly. The price tag on the coat said $500, but it had been reduced to $350, probably because the winter was half over. I decided to see if I could get an even better deal on this lovely coat. When the clerk came over, I told him that I liked the coat. He told me that it was the last one in stock. I told him that I would like to buy it, but that $350 was too much. He told me that there was nothing he could do about it because the price was fixed as written on the price tag. I realized that he had no authority to reduce the price, so I made him an offer. I said, "I'll give you $200 cash for the coat today, but I must have a decision by 2 p.m. this afternoon." He again replied that there was no way they could sell the coat for a penny less than $350. I then told him, "Why don't you go and talk to your manager, who was at lunch at the time, and I'll give you my telephone number. If you decide to accept the $200, please contact me within the next 2 hours at this number." I then went back to my apartment and waited. 90 minutes later, the telephone rang, and the clerk, sounding quite surprised, told me that the coat was mine for $200. When I went over to pick it up, he was still somewhat surprised. In all the time that he'd been working at the store, he had never seen the store vary from their posted prices. In fact, he said, no one had ever asked or offered a price lower than the prices on the tags. He shook my hand and congratulated me on having gotten a terrific deal. The point that I'm making with this story is that often the clerk that you're speaking to is not aware that the prices are negotiable. Often, you'll have to go over his or her head to the manager to arrange a better deal. Don't be afraid to do so. The very worst thing that can happen if you make a lower offer or ask for a lower price is that the manager will say no. In most cases, he or she will counteroffer. As a last resort, do what I did and give a fixed offer and your telephone number with a deadline for acceptance. It's amazing how flexible the company can be when they have the choice of making a small profit or no profit at all. Here are the hallmarks of a successful negotiator. This is a person who continually looks for creative ways to better the price, terms, or situation in his or her favor. The successful negotiator views the process of negotiation as a lifelong process, an ongoing, never-ending part of interacting and exchanging with other people. He sees negotiations going on everywhere, from the time he gets up in the morning and negotiates with his family for the bathroom or the kitchen, or how time is going to be spent later on in the day, to negotiating through traffic and negotiating all day long in the process of working with other people. The successful negotiator sees bargaining, trading, and compromising contained in all types of human interaction and exchange. The successful negotiator is open-minded, adaptive, and creative. The successful negotiator is willing to consider all types of options and possibilities in approaching a negotiating situation. The successful negotiator avoids taking fixed positions or digging in his or her heels with non-negotiable demands. The successful negotiator is fluid and flexible. He or she is quick to identify mutual goals and look for areas of compromise early in the negotiation in order to get the negotiations off to a smooth start. The successful negotiator is cooperative rather than competitive. Most successful negotiators continually seek for collaborative solutions to negotiating problems. They look for ways to come to agreements that are beneficial to both parties, as we'll talk about in a moment. The successful negotiator is continually looking for newer, easier, innovative, and unusual ways to help both parties in the negotiation to get what they want. And finally, The successful negotiator is honest, direct, and non-manipulative. The most effective negotiators are those who place a very high emphasis on the value of the relationship and on the importance of the two parties continuing to get along well together during and after the negotiations. This brings us to Gerald Nirenberg's definition of the purpose of negotiating. He says that the aim of negotiating is to reach an agreement such that all parties have their needs satisfied to the degree to which they are internally motivated to fulfill their commitments and enter into subsequent negotiations and transactions with the same party. That is a real mouthful, so let's break it down into its important parts. First, the purpose of negotiating is to reach an agreement such that all parties have their needs satisfied. This means that no one goes away from the negotiation feeling that he or she has suffered or been taken advantage of in any way. All of the critical needs of both parties are met by the agreement. Second, the purpose of negotiating is to reach an agreement such that all parties are internally motivated to fulfill their commitments. This means that a successful negotiation is one where both parties to the negotiation are strongly committed to carrying through with what they've agreed to do. If the negotiation has ended with acceptable solutions to the needs of both parties, both sides will be eager to fulfill their commitments in order to benefit from the fruits of the negotiation. In the final part of the definition, the purpose of negotiation is to reach an agreement such that both parties will enter into subsequent negotiations and transactions with the same party in the future. This means that if you've negotiated successfully, you will have laid the groundwork for future successful negotiations, negotiations that may go on for many years. In fact, the most successful business people and negotiators in America have built their careers and their fortunes on a network of business relationships where negotiations have taken place over and over again throughout their careers. A good negotiator thinks of the third and the fourth negotiation with the other party while he or she is involved in the first negotiation. This attitude creates a desire within both parties to enter into agreements that both can live with happily and comfortably for the long term. There are six basic styles of agreement, described by many authorities on negotiating, but perhaps best explained in Stephen Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. It's important for you to be aware of these various styles of negotiating so that you can select the style that's most appropriate to your long-term goals. The first style of negotiating is called win-lose negotiating. This is very common. It's the type of negotiating in which you get what you want while the other person does not. You are satisfied, if not oversatisfied, with the result, but the other party's not satisfied or happy at all. As you can see, this violates the purpose of negotiating described earlier. If the second party leaves a negotiation dissatisfied, he or she will have no desire to enter into subsequent negotiations with you because he will feel that he has lost. In a win-lose negotiation, the advantage is usually only temporary. It is a good idea for you to avoid entering into this type of win-lose arrangement, even when you have the power to do so. The second type of negotiation is lose-win negotiating. This is when the other party gets what he wants, but you fail to get what you want, so you leave the negotiation dissatisfied. Many people allow themselves to be railroaded into lose-win negotiations for fear of confrontation or offending the other party. Many psychologically manipulative people make a habit of putting others into lose-win situations, knowing that most people prefer to be accommodating rather than competitive or confrontative. It's important that you not allow anyone in your personal or business life to put you into a lose-win situation. When this happens, a dynamic is created that makes it very likely that it will happen again. A lose-win situation is often accompanied by intimidation, ultimatums, and threats to do or not do something to or for you. In a relationship, if one person values the relationship more than the other, and the other takes advantage of this difference in emotional commitment, a lose-win situation can arise. Both win-lose and lose-win situations of reaching agreement may benefit one party in the short term, but they're invariably unsuccessful in the long term. Eventually, the party who feels that he or she has lost in the negotiation will eventually leave the relationship and will refuse to enter into any kind of an agreement with the other party in the future. The third style of negotiating is called lose-lose. In this situation, neither party gets what he wants. Often people get into what is called positional bargaining, where they dig in on their positions and invest their egos in being right and winning. When this happens, the two parties would rather not come to an agreement at all rather than come to an agreement where the other party might benefit. Often, in relationships, when egos get in the way, the two parties will argue, disagree, and finally settle on a solution that pleases neither of them. Most lose-lose agreements are invariably accompanied by high levels of emotional involvement by both parties in the negotiation. When you see yourself getting into a lose-lose negotiation, it's time to stand back and get your ego out of the way. The fourth style of negotiating is compromise. In a compromise, some wants of each party are fulfilled, but some are left unfulfilled. Both parties to the negotiation are partially satisfied and partially dissatisfied. Often, we enter into compromise agreements to avoid conflict or to reach some kind of conclusion so that we can get on with something else. Compromises may or may not be particularly satisfactory, but they always leave certain issues unresolved, issues that will come up later and be the subject of further conflict and further negotiation. The fifth style of negotiating is simply called no deal. The two parties to the negotiation agree to disagree. They can't reach a happy meeting ground where both are satisfied and both have their essential needs met, so they agree not to enter into an agreement at all. This is not particularly productive, but it does have the advantage of not creating a negative situation that would make it difficult, if not impossible, for the two parties to enter into further negotiations at another time. This no deal occurs most commonly when you're shopping around for an item, hiring someone or applying for a job, or merely rejecting an offer to buy or sell something. The sixth style of negotiating is called win-win negotiating. Win-win negotiating is a mature, rational process where two parties collaborate and cooperate to find a solution, often a third alternative to the positions of either, that satisfies the needs of both. Here are some typical examples of these methods of negotiating. For example, there's a couple who is negotiating on where they're going to go for their summer vacation. He wants to go to the mountains and she wants to go to the seashore. He doesn't particularly like the beach and she doesn't particularly like the mountains. In a win-lose negotiation, he would insist and they would end up going to the mountains. He would be happy and she would be unhappy or dissatisfied. In a lose-win negotiation, perhaps in order to keep the peace, they go to the seashore for their vacation. She has her needs met, but he is left dissatisfied. In a lose-lose negotiation, they would go to neither the seashore nor the mountains, but would instead visit their in-laws or stay at home for their summer vacation. In this case, neither party would be satisfied. Both parties would lose, with no advantage being gained by either. In a compromise negotiation, they would go to the seashore for half of their vacation and to the mountains for the other half. Each party would get something of what he or she wanted, and each party would be dissatisfied for half the time. This is the weakness in compromises, in that satisfaction is never fully guaranteed to either party. If they decide to do a no-deal negotiation, they could decide not to go on vacation at all that year. Or she could go to the seashore and he could go to the mountains, both on separate vacations. They could agree to disagree, but while each would be partly satisfied, no happy solution would have been found. In a win-win negotiation, they would seek to discover a third alternative that would satisfy the needs of both, her need for the sunshine and the beach, and his need for the mountains and the pine trees. An example of such a win-win solution to this negotiation would be to visit Vancouver, British Columbia, for their summer vacation. In Vancouver, the mountains meet the sea. In downtown Vancouver, a person is only 20 minutes from the mountains or 15 minutes from the beach. She could go to the beach all day while he went to the mountains all day, and they could get together each evening. Both would have their major needs satisfied, and they would still be taking their summer vacation together and enjoying each other's company. In my experience with patience, creativity, and serious thinking, a third alternative is almost always available to two parties who feel that they have reached an impasse in solving a problem and in resolving a negotiation. If you look long enough and hard enough in the right spirit, you can almost always find a way to reach a win-win agreement of some kind. And this is the key. Your attitude must be win-win or no deal. You must be committed to finding a solution that satisfies the basic needs of both parties, or you must agree to disagree. In any case, you will not accept a win-lose, a lose-win, a lose-lose, or a compromise solution. It will be win-win or no deal. When you start from that point of view, you'll be amazed at how much more readily you will move toward win-win solutions in each negotiation. This entire session, by the way, is based on the win-win model. All of the strategies, tactics, and techniques that you will learn here will be geared toward teaching you to be an excellent negotiator in the process of moving toward genuine win-win solutions. Here are some of the critical elements in successful win-win negotiating. The first of these critical elements is power. No one will negotiate with you seriously unless they feel that you have the power to help them get something they want or the power to hurt them in some way. Power is a critical factor in all interactions and negotiations between two people who want something from each other. Whether or not you genuinely have power, it's important that you create the perception of having power. One way you can create the perception of power in a negotiation is by appearing to be indifferent to whether or not the negotiation works out. A person who appears uninterested or indifferent in a negotiation always has a psychological edge over a person for whom the negotiation is more important. You can also convey the perception of power by real or implied scarcity. For example, if you're selling something, you can say or imply that you have only one or a few left and that they'll soon all be sold no matter what the other party agrees to at this time. You can control a scarce and desired product, service, or item, which gives you an element of power in a negotiation. You can also create the perception of power by conveying authority. You can dress with authority, carry yourself with authority, and have a title that seems to give you enormous authority. This perception of authority can be very persuasive in a negotiation. You can also create the perception of power through courage. When you seem to be willing to take a risk or go out on a limb in any negotiation, it creates a perception which often causes the other party to deal with you more seriously. There are six major forms of power that are used in negotiating. It's important that you be aware of these forms of power so that you can use them when appropriate and so that you can avoid being the victim of them if they're used on you. The first power is the power of commitment. A person who is most committed and most determined to working out a deal and finding a solution has a form of power that the person who is wishy-washy or unsure lacks. A person who is committed and determined to make a sale is a far more formidable opponent in a negotiation than a person who's not thought about it or who is hesitant. The second power is the power of expertise. A person with superior knowledge and recognized expertise in the field, such as a medical or legal specialist or an engineer or architect, has a tremendous amount of power in a negotiation. What he or she says carries a lot more weight than that of a person who lacks the expertise. Even quoting a recognized expert or carrying some kind of written statement or proof by such an expert can give you power in a negotiating situation. The third type of power is the power of the knowledge of the needs of the other. The person who knows what the other person wants and needs better has a special form of power in a negotiation. Another form of power, the fourth, is the power of identification or empathy with the other party. Your ability to form a warm relationship based on trust, empathy, and understanding gives you a tremendous edge in a negotiation. When a person really likes you, he's much more amenable to working out a solution that is agreeable to both of you. The fifth form of power is the power of rewarding or punishment, having the ability to do or not do something for the other person. A boss, for example, has this power. A boss has the power to raise a person's wages, to promote a person, or to fire or demote a person. When you negotiate with a person who can either reward or punish you, it's very important that you develop viable options and alternatives so that you have something to fall back on. Other than that, you're entirely at the mercy of the person with this power of reward and punishment. The final form of power in a negotiation, the sixth form, is the power of investment. The more time and money that either party has invested in the negotiation, the more likely it is that the parties will be willing to compromise to achieve an agreement. When a negotiation begins, neither party has a lot at stake. However, the more time, the more money, and the more energy invested in going back and forth, the more each of the parties will have at stake. This brings us to another key element in negotiating, and that's the element of desire. The emotion of desire is a critical determinant of what happens in a negotiation. How badly do you want it? How badly does he or she want it? The person who gets the most emotionally involved in a negotiation is the person who has the least power in that negotiation. Chinese jade merchants are famous for their technique of showing only one piece of jewelry at a time. No matter how blank the face of the prospective customer, the jade merchants are trained to watch for the dilation of the pupils of the eyes. They can always tell when they've shown a piece that the prospective customer finds particularly attractive. The customer's eyes light up. They are then prepared to negotiate only for the sale of that particular piece. When you intensely desire to purchase something, you often give it away in your face, your body, your tone of voice, and your behavior. It's therefore very important that you practice detachment, especially with an emotional purchase such as a house or a car. This brings us to what I call the walk-away method of negotiation. This is a very useful technique based on my discovery while living in Mexico and bargaining in the marketplace that you never know the lowest price until you turn to walk away. I can remember negotiating for a piece of gold jewelry in Puerto Vallarta and not getting the merchant down low enough, so I used this walk-away technique. I really wanted the jewelry, but I realized that if I hesitated or turned around, I would lose, so I walked out of the store and kept walking for an entire city block. The merchant cracked first. As I got a full block away, the merchant, who had been watching me, his eyes boring into my back, finally broke and came running after me to sell me the jewelry at the last price I had offered. There are many ways in which you can use this walk-away technique. The critical part of this technique is your mental attitude. You must be prepared to walk away from a deal if you're going to get the best deal. You must be prepared to give up your investment in time, emotion, energy, and even money and walk out of the negotiation if that's what it takes. You can only use this walk-away method of negotiating when you have excellent information about the cost structure and competitive pricing of what it is you're trying to buy. You must be prepared to go through with your threat to leave and never come back. But if you're prepared to walk away, it gives you a tremendous position of strength in bargaining for any large or small item for which there are a lot of suppliers and therefore a very competitive market. Try it yourself and see. The third important element in negotiating is time. There's a very big difference between a negotiation conducted within tight time constraints to one that is conducted with all the time in the world. There's an old saying, no urgency, no sale. It's important for you to imply that you have all the time in the world and that you're in no rush to make any kind of a decision. The more time you appear to have, the more advantage you have in negotiating price and terms. It's to your advantage, however, to be sure to set a deadline for a decision whenever possible. Often, if you give people a very short period of time to make up their minds one way or the other, they will move to a decision quickly rather than to draw it out. On the other hand, you should try to avoid being rushed in any way. It's very hard for you to make a decision or negotiate the best agreement when you're under time pressure and time constraints. The most important element in negotiating is the number of options that you have to the subject of the negotiation. The more options or alternatives you have, the better off you are. Your strength lies in developing as many alternatives as possible before you go into the negotiation. If you have no choice but to settle for one item, you have no freedom at all. In fact, a rule for happiness in life is that you are free in direct proportion to the number of options that you have developed. A very good way to develop options is to sit down with a pad of paper and use the 20 idea method. At the top of the page, write the question, "What alternatives do I have if this negotiation fails completely?" Then, force yourself to write 10 to 20 answers to that question. This will give you a tremendous psychological edge in a negotiation, knowing that you already have lots of alternatives developed. In an earlier session, I talked about goals and how the ability to set goals and make plans for their accomplishment is the master skill of success. This rule applies equally to negotiating. Make very clear goals for each negotiating situation. You must know what you want, and you must know what you are prepared to give to get it. Clarity is essential. Think it through clearly in advance, and think on paper. Clearly define your ideal outcome from this negotiation. Write out a description of exactly what you would like to see happen if the negotiation succeeds completely the way you would like it to. Discuss this ideal outcome with others to get their input and their feedback. The person who is perfectly clear about what he or she wants has a powerful advantage over the person who is vague or unsure. In clarifying what you want, it's advisable to develop three numbers. The first number, especially if you're buying or selling something, is the highest and the best that you think you can get. The second number is what you would settle for, what you might call a medium or middle range figure. The last number is the lowest amount that you would accept. This is the worst possible outcome of the negotiation. You would hate to have to accept this amount, but if necessary, you would go along with it. These numbers represent what are sometimes called your opening position, your fallback position, and your final fallback position. However, the more time that you spend in thinking through these numbers and figures, the more effective you will be in a negotiation. You can always open a negotiation with a number that is slightly higher than your ideal, and you will always know where you are. You know that you will never accept less than your final fallback or your worst possible outcome, so you can negotiate confidently within that range. Preparation is the key to successful negotiating. Perhaps 80% of the success of a negotiation is determined by the quality and quantity of the preparation you do prior to the negotiation. There are several items that you need to prepare for before you begin to negotiate, especially when you're negotiating something that is expensive or important to you or your company. The first is the subject matter. Exactly what is to be discussed? What is the subject of the negotiation? It's amazing how many people go into negotiations without having found out for sure what the reason for the negotiation is in the first place. You need to prepare with regard to objectives. What are your objectives in the negotiation? What are his objectives in the negotiation? Sometimes calling the person or asking him or her what he or she expects to get from a negotiation will give you a tremendous amount of information. Sometimes calling other people who are aware of the situation will give you insights that can be very valuable. What are the issues to be discussed in the negotiation? Where do you differ from the other party in your wants and needs? Where are the potential areas of conflict and debate? And the final key to preparation is positions. What are the starting positions of each party? What are you and what is the other party likely to lead off with as an initial demand or as an initial position? Positions are usually the starting point in a negotiating situation. Positions are made up of your essentials, your limits, your maximums, your minimums. What must he get from this negotiation? What does he also want to get from this negotiation? What areas are you inflexible on, and what areas are you willing to concede in? Where can you make concessions without damaging what you feel you must get from this negotiation? Take a piece of paper and draw a line down the center. In the left-hand column, write all of your musts, the things you must achieve with this negotiation. In the right-hand column, make a list of all of your wants or things that would be nice to accomplish. Keep the two lists clear in your mind when you're negotiating. And finally, with regard to positioning, what tie-in concessions can you require to achieve agreement or to get concessions from the other party? If you're willing to give up on some things, what can you ask for in return? Can you ask for a better price, better terms, better delivery, or can you ask for certain things to be added or deleted from the final package? A valuable exercise in preparing for negotiations is what lawyers do in preparing a case before they go to court. They begin by arguing the case from the other person's viewpoint. They put themselves in the position of the other lawyer, and they prepare the other lawyer's case from beginning to end. Only then do they go to work to prepare their case, having carefully thought out everything that might possibly happen in the courtroom. If you practice empathy, you can begin to see the negotiation through the eyes of the other person. You can put yourself in his shoes, or, as the Indians say, walk a mile in his moccasins. You can make a list of all the things that you think he or she wants to or needs to achieve in this negotiation. That can then be your starting point for preparing what you will concede and what you will ask. Perhaps the most important part of this entire discussion on preparing is having the discipline to sit down with a pad and paper and clearly think through what you are trying to accomplish before you begin the negotiations. A lot of misunderstandings arise in negotiating. Remember, errant assumptions lie at the root of most mistakes. A major reason for misunderstanding in negotiations is false or incorrect assumptions held by both parties as the result of a lack of clarity. It's a useful exercise for you to sit down and think through your assumptions, both your known assumptions and your hidden assumptions. One of the assumptions, for example, that we all tend to have when entering into a negotiation is that the other party wants to reach an agreement. Often, this assumption is false. Sometimes, we assume that the other party has either more information or less information than we give him or her credit for. False assumptions can be very damaging both to negotiations and to relationships. Ask yourself, what if my assumptions were not true? Examine your most cherished or your most important assumptions. What if they weren't true at all? What if the product or service was not as good as it seemed to be? What if the price was not as reasonable as it appeared? What if the other person was not negotiating in good faith? Be willing to be brutally frank and honest in questioning or challenging your pet assumptions. This is the mark of the skilled thinker and the excellent negotiator. Once you've identified your assumptions, how can you test them? How can you gather information to assure that your assumptions are based on fact rather than fantasy? Sometimes, a little effort in testing assumptions can be worth its weight in gold in bringing a negotiation to a conclusion that is in your favor. What are the assumptions of the other person? On what basis is the other person negotiating? Does the other person have known or hidden assumptions that may or may not be correct? How could you find out what the other person's assumptions are? How can you clarify each other's assumptions? This is an excellent question. If you're working toward a cooperative, win-win negotiating solution, then it's normal and natural for you to sit down in advance and clarify each other's assumptions so that you're both negotiating from the same basis. You are both on the same page. The best way to do this is to use what we call the fact-finding approach. Sit down and ask questions, gathering data objectively as though you were doing an interview for a newspaper or magazine. Make out a list of your questions and not only ask the questions, but share your answers and your assumptions with the other party. When the other party tells you what he or she is thinking or feeling, take the time to feed it back in your own words. Paraphrase it and do so until the other person agrees that yes, you do understand where he or she is coming from. A good question to ask at the beginning is, why do you feel that we are here, and what would you ideally like to accomplish in this meeting? If you ask this question, why do you feel we are here, and what would you ideally like to accomplish in this meeting, before you begin negotiating, you can often clarify each other's assumptions and begin negotiating from a better foundation. For example, some years ago, my wife and I decided to move to the San Diego area. We came and looked at homes three times over the next 15 months before we were actually ready to buy a house. In that time, we explored a variety of neighborhoods and did a lot of price shopping and price comparing. When we finally decided to purchase a house, we contacted the same realtor with whom we'd been working from the beginning and began once more looking at houses in the neighborhoods that we had felt were the most attractive and appropriate for our family. Taking the multiple listing service records of homes for sale and homes that had sold over the previous years, I spent several hours drawing up a series of comparatives for the size of house, size of lot, number of bedrooms, neighborhood, whether or not it had a pool, age of house, and location, and so on. With more than 150 home sales to use as a basis for my information, I finally came up with an average price per square foot that I felt was reasonable to pay in the current market for the kind of house we were looking for. After looking at more than 50 houses, our real estate agent phoned and said that there was a house that we might like to see, but she doubted whether or not it would be ideal for us. As soon as we walked through the door, however, we knew that this was the house we wanted. It had high vaulted ceilings, Italian marble floors, four bedrooms, plus a master bedroom and a guest suite and a private office for myself. It had a spacious, high-ceiling family room looking out onto a swimming pool and jacuzzi, and the entire home overlooked a beautiful golf course. The home satisfied all the requirements that we had determined we wanted in our process of setting goals for our dream house. I knew that a home of this size in this area would sell at a price of somewhere between 85% and 95% of the asking price, and that it would take approximately 9 months to sell and 6 months to close. I'd gathered this information from going through the multiple listing records of similar home sales. I felt that with this information at my disposal, I was in a position to negotiate a good deal, even though there was no question at all that we wanted this house and we were willing to pay almost whatever it took to get it, up to and including the full asking price. Rather than go through the real estate agent, submitting an offer and then having it counter-offered back and forth, I immediately requested a meeting with the owner of the house. The meeting took place in the offices of the real estate company that had the house for sale. I explained to the owner about my research and my belief that it would take approximately 9 months for the house to sell. I also explained my research into the average sales prices of homes in that area, and then I made him an offer of $650,000, which was substantially below the asking price of $750,000. He thanked me for my offer, but made no commitment, saying that he would think it over and let me know through the realtors. A day later, the realtor phoned and told me that the owner had declined the offer without any counteroffer. The ball was back in my court completely. Since we really wanted the house, I decided to dispense with the use of the realtors as go-betweens, and I phoned the owner directly to arrange another meeting. At our meeting, I explained to him the concept of the walk-away price. I told him that rather than negotiating back and forth, I would ask him to set the price at the price below which he would not go. I would then be able to tell him yes or no with regard to that price, and all of the effort of negotiating could be avoided. He told me that he would think about it and would get back to me within a couple of days. When he phoned, he explained that after considerable thought, he and his wife had decided that the minimum price they could sell the house for, taking the real estate commissions of $42,000 into consideration, was a gross amount of $725,000. We were willing to go as high as $700,000. He was willing to go as low as $720,000. The stumbling block was the $42,000 real estate commission that would come off the top of the sales price. I suggested that he go back to the real estate agent and negotiate some reduction in the commission. Even though the real estate agent had only had the house listed for 2 weeks and had only shown it to two people prior to my making an offer to purchase, they were reluctant to reduce their commission at all. I then did a walkaway on the real estate agents. I told them that unless they were willing to reduce their commission, I would have to shop somewhere else. The very next day, I began looking at other houses with another real estate agent, knowing that the information would get back to our original agents. Within the week, they had dropped their commission by $10,000. After another 2 weeks of stonewalling and bluffing, we finally settled on a price of $710,000, with the real estate agents reducing their commission again in order to make the sale come together. It's worth pointing out that this was a win-win negotiation for everyone involved. The seller of the home got the amount of money that he required to be satisfied. My wife and I got the home that we required to be satisfied and more than satisfied. The real estate agents got an excellent commission for very little effort, and they were also satisfied. There are several suggestive elements in negotiating as well that you should bear in mind, especially in a tricky or difficult negotiation where there's ample opportunity for it to go in either direction, depending upon a variety of factors. The power of suggestion is inordinately strong in shaping the way people think, feel, and react. Some psychologists have estimated that as much as 95% of our thoughts and feelings at any given time are determined by our external environment and what is going on around us, especially our external human environment. A key suggestive element, for example, in negotiating is the location of the negotiation, where the negotiation takes place. It's always preferable to have the negotiation in your office or at your home, at least on your turf. When a person comes onto your property or into your office to negotiate, you have a psychological advantage because you are familiar and comfortable with the terrain. If someone invites you to negotiate in their office or on their premises, and you can't counter by having them come to your offices, you can suggest a neutral turf, such as a restaurant or a hotel. Almost all major negotiations are conducted in a place that is satisfactory to both parties. A second suggestive element is the personality of the negotiator. A warm, friendly, and supportive individual has a much more positive effect on the other party than a negative, cold, or distant person would have. The more you are empathetic and sensitive to the quality of the relationship, the easier it is for the other person to negotiate with you and to concede to you on minor and even major points. A third suggestive element in negotiating is the positioning of the various parties. The traditional group negotiating setup where the parties sit on opposite sides of the table often makes reaching an agreement very difficult. You probably remember the months of negotiating that went on during the Paris peace talks between the United States and North Vietnam over the size and shape of the tables at which the negotiators would sit. The North Vietnamese were very aware of the importance of positioning around the table in making symbolic statements about the relative power and authority of each person. The very best positioning for a negotiation is at a round table and side by side. Whenever possible, try to avoid sitting face to face or opposite the other person. If there are several people involved in a negotiation, a good way to break down the psychological barriers to it is to alternate the members of each team around the table so that they're spread throughout the room. At the very least, always seek to sit next to your major negotiating opponent. This implies cooperation and conciliation rather than competition and an adversarial relationship. The fourth key suggestive element in negotiating is the timing, as I've discussed before. A relaxed negotiation with apparently all the time in the world is far different from a negotiation that's rushed with one party or the other having to be somewhere else in a short period of time. As was said before, never allow yourself to be rushed. If there's not enough time to conclude the negotiation satisfactorily, be willing to delay the completion of the negotiation to another day when there's more time. It's very common for manipulative negotiators to use the press of time urgency as a weapon in their favor. A fifth key suggestive element of negotiating is comfort. The comfort of the chairs, the level of fatigue of the various parties, the amount of hunger, thirst, or jet lag that one party or the other is suffering are key elements in a negotiation. a negotiation is always helped by one party or the other being solicitous of the physical needs of the other. The sixth suggestive element is that of attitude. A negotiator with a positive, cheerful, and optimistic attitude is a much more inviting person to reach agreement with than a person who is negative or abrasive. One of the most important parts of a positive attitude is the willingness to be calm and patient throughout the negotiations. In my experience, the very best negotiators tend to be very low-keyed, patient, and even gentle men and women. This attitude on their part goes a long way toward relaxing the other party and making the other party amenable to their suggestions. One final point on the suggestive influences of negotiating, and that is that all negotiations proceed better after eating or during a meal. When people are hungry, they have a natural tendency to be irritable and uncooperative. But when people have eaten, they experience a generalized feeling of well-being that bodes well for successful negotiating. For negotiating a complex agreement, start off by getting agreement on as many small items as possible before settling down to hammer out the more difficult issues. I've personally negotiated several multi-million dollar real estate development and construction contracts, as well as a great number of long-term leases for retail and commercial property. Whenever I've sat down with the negotiators from the other side to go through one of these 50 or 60-page contracts, my method has always been to go through the contract clause by clause, discussing and getting agreement on each area where we have no difficulties. Whenever we would come to a clause or to a sticking point where there was obviously going to be a difference of opinion and a need to negotiate some satisfactory compromise, I would always say, "Let's come back to that later." This method of agreeing with everything with which you can possibly agree before you settle down to negotiating and discussing the areas where you have differences is always the most effective. The more small agreements that you can reach at the beginning of a negotiation, the more likely it is that you will reach agreement on the larger issues later. On every issue where money or concessions are involved, you should agree slowly and reluctantly, but with reasonableness and fairness. I always lace a negotiation with concessions that I describe as fair to everyone involved. The more you can set a tone of fairness throughout the negotiation, the less likely it is that the other party will be unreasonable when you get down to the main issues. In a Harvard study on negotiation, they concluded that the most satisfactory way to negotiate opposing points of view was what they called tit for tat. This simply said that for every concession, the other party should expect an equal and opposite concession. Whenever you make a concession in any area, you should, as a matter of principle, request an equal concession in some other area. If you don't ask for a reciprocal concession, the other party will place too little value on what you're giving up. Another technique you can use is called persuasion by social proof. This simply means that people are swayed in their opinions by learning of other people such as themselves who've entered into the same agreement which you are suggesting that they enter into. Whenever you use facts, numbers, names, and statistics from reputable sources to show that others are making similar agreements to the one that you're requesting the other party enter into, you are using persuasion by social proof. This is a very powerful technique. Whenever you can refer to other similar people in other similar situations who have accepted the terms that you are urging the other party to, you're demonstrating the reasonableness and fairness of your position. Again, this is a matter of careful preparation in advance of the negotiation so that you have the knowledge and the proof at your fingertips at the critical moment. Remember, though, that assertions are not proof. What you say or insist upon is not usually accepted as proof in a negotiation. You must have validation in the form of printed material, testimonial letters, or names or lists of others that can be used as proof or referrals in order to sway the negotiation in your favor. Let me give you an example. A few years ago, we hired a secretary at $800 per month. She was young and needed the work, and she had just left a job paying slightly less than that. We had just opened an office, and we needed someone to take care of the telephones, the typing, the bank deposits, and a lot of other various miscellaneous details. The young woman we hired was 22 years old. She did an excellent job and whipped our little operation into shape within a couple of months. At that point, as an expression of appreciation, I called her in and gave her an increase from $800 to $1,000 per month, for which she was duly grateful. Not long after that, we bought a Macintosh computer, and she immediately taught herself how to use it and began doing all of our workbooks and correspondence on the computer. As our accounting became more complex, she taught herself how to do basic accounting, bookkeeping, and monthly financial statements, and then she took over that part of the business also. After she'd been with me for about 6 months, she asked if she could speak to me at some time about her salary. I knew that she was going to ask for an increase, and as I was feeling very big-hearted because of the fine job she was doing, I decided that I would give her an increase of 15%, or an extra $150 per month, bringing her salary to $1,150, or an increase of approximately 45% in the 6 months since she had begun. I thought that she would be quite happy with this amount. Well, she came in and closed the door and sat down, told me that she felt that she deserved an increase. I responded by telling her that I agreed and that I was going to give her an extra $150 per month. She replied by saying that she appreciated the thought, but that she had been doing her homework in the marketplace. She had spoken to 3 personnel agencies and had checked among her friends to find out what a person performing her functions would be paid in another company. She had come to the conclusion that her job was worth between $1,500 and $1,600 per month, based on the work that she was doing. I couldn't believe it. She was sitting there asking for a 50% increase after only 6 months on the job. In fact, it was more than that, because I'd already given her an increase after 2 months. As I sat there looking at her and she sat there looking at me, I suddenly realized 2 things. The first thing I realized was that she was definitely worth the extra money and that it would probably cost me $1,500 to replace her, plus the inconvenience involved if she decided to leave, to walk away. The second thing I realized was that I had just been royally out-negotiated by a 22-year-old woman. I had negotiated millions of dollars worth of contracts with some of the most sophisticated business people in America, and I had just been flamboozled out of a 50% increase by this secretary because she had followed proper negotiating procedure. She'd gone out into the marketplace and done her homework. She had prepared carefully and planned the timing so that I would be in the office for several hours, not rushed, and willing and able to sit and talk with her. She'd prepared the environment in that she had someone else taking care of the telephones, and she'd closed the door behind her. She didn't tell me that she wanted a 50% increase because she needed the money. She told me that she wanted a 50% increase because, based on market statistics, which I hadn't checked, and therefore I couldn't confirm or deny, she was entitled to the extra money. As it happened, I gave her the increase she asked for. It was only afterwards that I realized how cleverly she had conducted the negotiation. The reason I tell this story is that one of the fastest ways for you to move up the financial ladder in your career is to get an increase and be paid substantially more than you're earning today by becoming a good negotiator. She did all the right things. She made herself more valuable in the areas that were critical for the ongoing survival of our business. She accepted additional responsibility. She went out and took computer courses in the evenings and on the weekends so that she could operate our Macintosh. She got her own instruction at night school on bookkeeping and accounting. She saw the opportunity to make herself virtually indispensable to our company, and she acted on the opportunity. When she was ready to ask for an increase, there was only one thing that we could do, and that was to give it to her. She was worth every penny of it. There are several negotiating tactics that you can use if you're attempting to purchase something for the lowest possible price. You should make a habit of using these tactics, even if the price is apparently reasonable. You'll be amazed at how much you can save on your day-to-day and month-to-month purchases using these simple methods. The first is called the flinch. When a price is mentioned, flinch as though you have just suffered a physical shock of pain and let your face express your amazement at the price. The very act of being surprised and even shocked that the price is that high will often cause the seller to drop the price in an instant. When I've traveled throughout the world, I found that the first flinch often drops the price by as much as 50%. You can use this flinch tactic when buying any expensive item, especially cars, appliances, stereo equipment, and most definitely in the case of real estate or any purchase where the price has been set arbitrarily. Remember, people almost always ask for more than they really expect to get. The second tactic is simply to question. After you've flinched and the prices come down, you ask, "Can't you do better than that?" Sometimes when you're in a store, they'll shrug their shoulders and say, "That's the price and I can't do anything about it. I don't set the prices." In a case like this, always ask, "Is this item ever on sale?" If the clerk or salesperson tells you that the item is occasionally on sale, ask how much it sells for when it's reduced. When you get the price, use the walk-away clause by offering that price today only and ask him or her to take it to his or her manager. Sometimes the manager will say no, in which case you simply leave your name and phone number and tell them that you'll wait for 24 hours before you purchase it somewhere else. You'll be surprised at how often the price will come down and the phone will ring. A third tactic in buying is just simply to tell the person, no matter what the price is, that you can get it cheaper somewhere else. The salesperson will always be surprised and hurt to hear you say this, but if they think that you can get it cheaper somewhere else, they will often be amenable to dropping the price for you right now, today. Another question you can use, after you've been negotiating and you don't seem to be able to get the price down any lower, is to ask, "What's the very best you can do if I make a decision today?" Whatever the person says in response, you haven't committed to buying it. And whatever the answer is, ask, "Is that the very best you can do? Can't you do better than that?" Don't be afraid to ask for a lower price. Remember, no one is going to sell you anything except at a profit. So the lower the price that you can get, the better off you'll be without hurting anyone else. Another price negotiating tactic is simply to make a lowball offer. Many real estate speculators will go out and make offers on homes for sale at 50% and 60% of the asking price. These speculators play the law of averages. They may make 100 offers, 99% of which are thrown back at them, but the 100th offer is accepted for a variety of reasons. The sellers may be desperate for cash. They may be going through a divorce. They may be moving overseas. They may have other reasons as well, but the point is that they will sometimes accept the first lowball offer that comes along. The sixth negotiating tactic is what negotiation expert Roger Dawson calls the nibble or add-on. Just after you've purchased a suit, but before you've taken out your credit card to pay for it, you ask the salesperson to throw in a shirt or a silk tie. After you've made an offer on the house, you ask the seller to throw in all the lawn mowing equipment, the garden furniture, the drapes, and a few other things. The nibble or add-on is a way to be sure that you get everything that you have coming from every purchase. One of the most common add-ons is when you buy something large is to ask them to include the cost of the shipping, freight, or delivery in the price. If they refuse, then pick up your credit card or your check and say, "Never mind, I'll get it somewhere else," and head for the door. It's very doubtful they'll let you get to the parking lot for the cost of a little freight. The seventh negotiating tactic that you can use is what is called an agent without authority. What this means is that you can take concessions, but you have no authority to make concessions. You say that you have to discuss it with your boss, your board of directors, your wife or husband, or you have to run it past your accountant or your lawyer. You can negotiate from a position of strength as an agent without authority, because all the other person can do is make concessions, while all that you can do is to accept them. Be alert to having any of these techniques used against you when you are negotiating. If a person says that he or she cannot make a decision without reference to someone else, you should refuse to continue negotiations until that other person is available. Often you'll find that this is merely a negotiating tactic and that this person can make any decision that he or she wants. And finally, remember that no negotiation is ever final. You are always entitled to change your mind or to rethink a negotiation. If you feel, in retrospect, that you've entered into a bad deal, don't be shy about going back to the original party and reopening the negotiations. Be willing to say, "I made a mistake," or I changed my mind. If, upon reflection, you feel uncomfortable or uneasy about the deal that you've made, pick up the telephone and call the person and simply say, I'm not happy with this agreement that we entered into. I would like to discuss it with you again and change some of the terms that we negotiated. Even if you have a signed contract, don't be shy about going back and asking for a change in the terms and conditions. All that the other person can say is no. If you can suggest concessions that you will make for the concessions that you are requesting, most serious business people will be open to renegotiating an agreement to assure that both parties are happy and satisfied with the result. Always start a renegotiation by tuning in to everyone's favorite radio station, WIIFM, What's in It for Me? If you want anyone to do something for you, put yourself in his or her position first and ask how you can do something for him or her. Remember, the purpose of negotiation is to come to an agreement in such a way that both parties are committed to fulfilling their parts of the agreement and are willing and eager to enter into subsequent negotiations with the same party. If anything happens to threaten or interfere with this purpose, you should feel free to reopen the negotiation and ask for a change in the terms and conditions. You can become an excellent negotiator if you remember the four essentials of negotiating. First, get the facts. Prepare in advance. Do your homework prior to the negotiation. Second, ask for what you want. Be clear about your objectives from the negotiation and be sure to ask clearly and ask persistently for exactly what it is that you want to get out of the negotiation. Third, seek win-win solutions at all times. Think about negotiating with this person again and again over the years. Make sure that both of you are fully satisfied with the result of the negotiation, even after having slept on it for 24 hours. And fourth, in order to be an excellent negotiator, you must take every opportunity possible to practice. When your children ask you for something, practice negotiating concessions from them in return. When your spouse asks you to do something, practice negotiating something in return. When your boss, your customers, your suppliers, and salespeople ask you for something or try to sell you something, make a habit of always negotiating to get a better deal. Always look for a way to reorganize the terms and conditions so as to improve the results you get. If you persist, prepare, and practice, you will become an excellent negotiator, and you will be able to negotiate your way to maximum performance and maximum achievement. Now here's an exercise for you. Make a list of those areas in your life where you feel that the deal that you have gotten or the deal that you're getting is not satisfactory. Pick the particular area or areas where your dissatisfaction is causing you to feel negative or unhappy for any reason. Then, sit down and, using what you have learned in these sessions on negotiating strategies and tactics, work out a plan to renegotiate the situation in such a way that it satisfies your essential needs. Be sure to think of a way to structure it so that it is win-win for all parties concerned. From this point on, whenever you feel that you are not getting a fair deal, resolve to go back in and renegotiate until you're satisfied with the outcome. Keep doing this until you become an accomplished negotiator in every area of your life.